Dr. Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about...
New Scientist, 17th of November, 2018, episode 5. We've just read an article about an island off the Horn of Africa, in the getting pretty much in the Gulf of Arabia, and the island's name is Socotra. Socotra, an island there, and it's part of Yemen, but very close to Somalia. There's a lot of confused concepts in there when you actually come to it. So the island is actually not a staging post for out of Africa, but there is another place between Djibouti and I forgot what the actual other place is in Africa. Between Djibouti and another, in Yemen, Djibouti and Yemen. So this is a small gap, which when, say, if the sea levels were lower, would be possibly quite easily traversable. So there's a point for anthropology in the area, but this Yemen sort of descended into... mayhem, and there's this Socotra is this island in the Pacific Ocean. There's actually it's a large island, but there's about five other islands, and the island scale is about 120 kilometers long. So it's a fairish size island there. I suppose the issue. The issue there is their claim that the amount of climate devastation going on this particular island is causing, is caused by climate change. There's certainly not the evidence. It seems to be an unquestionable truth, but it's not the evidence produced here. Okay. This next article goes, a bat and a ball together cost, I think I've done this one before, $1.10. Okay, so bat plus ball, so x plus y equals 110. The bat costs $1 more than the ball, so the bat minus the ball, so x minus y is, so that's two... okay, so that's $2.10 divided by 2 will give you $1.05 for the 5 cents. 5 cents for the ball. Is that right? It's not 10 cents for the ball, but it's 5 cents for the ball. 5 cents for the ball and $1.05 for the bat, but you just have to have a formula head to do it. So I wonder what they're talking about. Intuitive ideas about how the mind works have permeated popular culture and shaped everything from economics to advertising. But have we got it all wrong? Wonders Madeline Finlay. How much does the ball cost? If you instantly guess 10 cents, you're in a smart company. More than half of the students at Harvard University and MIT jumped to the same conclusion. But you'd be wrong. The answer is actually 5 cents a year. For years, the puzzle has been held up as a perfect example of the way we think being ruled by two types of mental processes, the fast intuitive versus the slow analytical. If you arrived at the wrong answer before you had time to really ponder the problem, you might blame your intuitive thinking, leading you to snap judgment before the slow rational thinking is deemed. And dare I say, the people who get 10 cents and don't wonder about it just wander off and have perfectly good company. And the people who save 5 cents are also good company with each other. The two groups really don't mix all that well. Okay. The idea that our thoughts can be split into two distinctive camps has become so popular it now influences many areas of everyday life. Marketeers try to tap into our automatic impulses with emotive adverts and special offers, while governments here, which is, the sale thing is just ridiculous, while governments attempt to appeal to our deliberative size by doing things like putting calorie counts on menus. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, these nudges are often based on the assumption that fast intuitive thinking is likely to get you into trouble, so we need to cultivate a slower kind. The US National Academy of Science, can I just say, the number of calories, I think we've got kilojoules. What really irritates me is the number of times they actually don't follow conventions and put a capital K and or a lowercase j. It's just, or not leave the space, or not or put the text incorrect. So they have it there, but it's just appalling. It's really insulting to scientists to look at it. So nudges is just a small thing. I think a nudge might be putting a ping pong ball in a toilet. Just gets people to pee in the toilet. I think that's a nudge. The US National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, Medicine and the World Bank have both issued reports urging decision makers to use slower types of thinking to avoid expensive or deadly mistakes of another form. Yeah, well, you really have to be... This is the whole thing of training officers to with all the shit going on, explosions going around, to go, now, what is the range? What weapon system do I have? Oh, he's dead. Okay, what are we doing next? That type of stuff. So not to get overly emotional. It's really interesting stuff to be officer trained. In terms of, there's officer training for, obviously, conflict. But then, once you've got an officer trained, they can go into a failing company and get an order done. You know, get the orders done, and then instead of turn up, dress up, ask for a loan. There is a use for officers being able to operate outside the when intuition is reigning in. But a more complex picture of our mental processes are beginning to emerge. Categorizing all our thoughts into one of these two types might in fact be leading us astray in all sorts of policies and practices. Armed with a new understanding of how we make decisions, we could all benefit. From Descartes' mind-body dualism, everyone thought that we're all in the mind of God, and Descartes got a difference between the mind and abstract soul. A distinction has long been drawn between the two opposing factions of instinct and conscious reasoning. I think Descartes said animals had no souls, something along those lines, they're just robots. Yet it wasn't, and what is it, Leibniz says, we lived in the best of all possible worlds. What a, just a joke. Yet it wasn't until 1975 that psychologists Michael Postia and Charles Snyder presented the first dual process model of the mind. In this paper, they describe an efficient automatic thought process that can be cooperative without intention, and an inefficient conscious process. Now, the issue is that the deliberative process we use with food and everything else that we don't care about. We're still back in the social thing. I remember going to a lecture on it. So this is perhaps why I know when I go to a problem like that, you just use mathematics, because I've been to a lecture on this. And it's apparently people's will have two same problems. One, they'll use the automatic quick, get on, gets to the next part thing. They're not really engaged, but if you've got food and they're really engaged, they will think it through if they can personalize it. However, it was Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman who turned the idea into a popular concept. Think fast and slow. In it, he describes that mental processes that typically belong to System 1 or System 2. Oh, God. At least it's... You're a type A or type B personality. Then if you've got type A or type B, it means it's a dichotomy. Or there's seven habits or some sort of factor of seven or prime number involved. It's seven habits seems to be the likely thing. Create the difference between a joke and a riddle. A good joke is funny without needing to think about exactly why. It taps into System 1, while a riddle, however, it requires us to learn on System 2, taking some time of burrow firing to get that moment of satisfaction. Since the book's publication, the dual process model of mind has blossomed into one of the most widely accepted ideas in psychology, becoming pervasive in research with real world implications. Quote, the popularity of the book due to the intuitive appeal of the two systems. Isn't that beautiful? That we're using system one to like a two system model. Says, who is at Princeton University? Those studying topics with political beliefs and criminal decision making and lie detection have used the model to investigate the source of our behaviours and belief. Research on binge drinking, for example, suggests that this impulsive behaviour is caused by an overactive system one, which can be identified as a source of interviewers' false impressions of job applicants. The model has been at the heart of the evidence given by policymakers about the implicit effects of advertising. I really think if you're looking at a system of bullying and corruption, to get off the fact that they're doing the wrong thing, is just look at the quality of their analysis, is try and get in. And that's spurred on by new evidence from neuroscience. The problem of reproducing some experimental results linked to the dual process model, a growing number of psychologists are starting to wonder whether our most complex organ really operates in such a conveniently simple fashion. Talk about loading the answer. Quote, it's such a sticky idea because it makes intuitive sense and resonates with people's experience. It's one of these babushka dolls, the concepts within the concept of reference, says Magna Osman, an experimental psychologist at Queen Mary University of London. But having a false, I think it would be rather nice to be an experimental psychologist rather than a real psychologist. Myself, frankly, having had psychologists sort of measure you, it's sort of a pretty thankless, hard, complex thing to do. Conception of the mind can be damaging. How we think or think we're about thinking can challenge our entrench our biases, help us avoid mistakes or cause them. So I would say the inability to conduct a conversation about how you think belies a system in crisis. I think if you cannot ask people to sit down and talk, that's one thing. To be fair, they often view you as a nutcase, get out of my face type of thing. One example Osman gives is something she calls Prince Charming effect, in which we separate automatic thoughts from conscious intentional ones to absolve or rescue ourselves from our mistakes and biases. If something goes wrong, she quotes, it saves us and excuses our behaviour, she says. Take the bat and ball problem. Some people tend to feel better if they believe that coming up with the answer 10 cents was uncontrollable, unconscious response, or that they're in that group of people who can actually run the place. Making mistakes qualifies me to be your boss. At a personal, because, all the other bosses make mistakes, and we're in a mistake-ridden world, so hello there. At a personal level, this might seem a minor consideration, but it raises little serious questions for society as a whole. Quote, if someone commits a crime and says in court, I didn't do it intentionally, I just wasn't thinking, it was an automatic response. We recognise that we might be inclined to see them as less responsible for their actions, says Osman. Might even feel that it wasn't really them at all. However, if our minds have more than two clear-cut modes, then deciding when something is intentional or worthy of blame is much more challenging. And this is a really complex problem that they're talking about. And so she's getting into how you apply the model. David Mikoff at Yale University agrees. For over a decade, it was an idea that because stereotyping was type 1 process, it couldn't possibly be consciously accessed. He points to the implicit association test developed in 1998, in which participants matched two targets for concepts as quickly as possible. Typically, we react faster when pairing are more strongly associated, reflecting participants' implicit attitudes and stereotypes. The test has since widely been used as a way to reveal unconscious bias. But, in 2014, participants in another experiment were asked to predict the strength of their biases before the test. It turned out their guesses were pretty accurate. Our biases aren't unconscious as we would believe. It still says the test is quite good, so the test can actually can do it. Findings like these have led Osman Melnikov and others to question the binary model of our minds. Okay, so if we know we've got biases, if it is a binary model and we're aware of it, then that's a problem, isn't it? For them, the critical point is that there's little evidence that the features of these two kinds of thinking, such as automatic and quick, deliberative and conscious, actually go together at all. This idea is taken as fact, but it's never been tested, says Mikov. Plus, there's a reason to suspect. These features aren't correlated. There are plenty of examples where they aren't aligned. I would say context is a major point. So, I think if you're in a group of people who are just pathologizing everything as a way of life, they can, you know, the tensions can really get. Take language. We deliberately communicate, but in the flow of conversation, we don't consciously rehearse what we're going to say or the grammatical rules that we need to use. It's intentional and at the same time unconscious. The same can be said of driving on a familiar route, typing or playing a well-rehearsed tune on an instrument. We can even solve novel problems without being aware of how we do. People think that rules can't be processed unconsciously, says Mikov. This isn't true either. Just take a look at the deck of cards opposite. You probably guess intuitively without needing to cogitate that the next card would be a 10 of spades. Oh, okay. That's a series of spades. Well, I had to consciously go through and do it myself. Studies involving puzzles like this show that we can process logic rules in an unconscious but effortful manner. In contrast, think about the bat and ball again. We can purposefully, we can also purposefully try to solve the puzzle and yet still come up with a compulsive but erroneous response. Unconscious influence. Other studies are further blurring the boundary between conscious and unconscious mental processes. In an experiment in which participants were given an identical testing drink containing either glucose or calorie-free sweeteners, those who had consumed the sugar perceived a hill to be less steep than asked to estimate the slope. This indicates, at an unconscious level, your body is telling you how the world looks based on what's capable and what's at the moment, says Simone Sanchel of the University of Cambridge, who led the study. Unconscious factors can influence our perception. What a brilliant test. What a brilliant idea. I think you can also do it by varying the hill strength. Some people, like Osman and Mankov, these examples all point to a bigger question. Is it really possible to distinguish between the two systems? In fact, we may be barking up the wrong tree altogether. Quote, "It's still a debate over many of the features, let alone the categories," says Osman. "Demonstrating that things are unconscious and conscious is unbelievably hard. Usually you end up drawing arbitrary distinctions like how fast is, without good evidence to resolve such difficulties. Opponents argue that there is no reason to assume System 1 and System 2 exist at all. Yet, Kahneman believes critics have missed the point." Okay, of course he would. He's the author of the Fast and Slow Way. "It's a framework and not a theory which can be used to make sense of phenomenological experiences," he says. So theory is a system of explanation. A law is a consistent observation. So the law of gravity is that things fall down. Consistently, I always observe that that's a law, but a law doesn't result from a theory. He argues that a metaphor of System 1 and 2 can go a long way to describing thinking and aiding understands of how we think. For him, a bat and ball problem is so this idea that a theory becomes a law. The law of gravity existed way before the theory. The law of gravity was something, a law, and a theory does not become a law. Sorry, I must say this. The number 10 is produced associatively like 2 plus 4. It's clearly System 1. The computational part, where you take away 10 cents from 100, calculate the difference and so on, that's clearly System 2. In that example, there's no ambiguity. Even when things are less geek, argues Kahneman, almost all processes are a mix of both systems, each of which represents a list of characteristics that are likely to apply, but aren't set in stone. For him, counter-arguments fail to address the main reason the idea is so popular. We all have experience of two different ways of coming up with thoughts and making decisions, passive association or active thinking. And because of this intuitive appeal, it's going to be tough to change moral acceptance, and that this is how it is, says Osman, even if the researchers are divided on the subject. There's still a lot of uptake by governments and industry, she says. It's going to be hard to shift such a popular view. In the meantime, this is, I think, really goes in science thinking in terms of that we have to get people engaged with intuitive thinking and then move them through the two thinking ways. In the meantime, most critics and proponents agree on is the need to dispel the good-bad fallacy. This is the assumption that because System 1 is automatic and unconscious, it's an error prone, whereas System 2 is analytic and therefore correct. I think it's ridiculous, says Kahneman. It's a common misunderstanding that System 1 is irrational and System 2 is rational. In fact, he regards the automatic system as more developed, complex and useful. System 1 is not a machine for making errors, he says. It usually functions beautifully. Unconscious processing can let us perform well-practiced skills more quickly and easily. Minkoff puts it, don't tell an athlete to think about their swing during a match. No, in actual fact, you have to actually distract them. As well as giving our unconscious too much of a bad rap, the fallacy increases the risk of not holding our conscious thinking to account. Humans have a lot of bad habits and biases. We ignore evidence like we dislike, rationalize our biases, produce questionable justifications for bad decisions. I only had a small breakfast, so it's fine to have a big slice of cake. We often end up overthinking. In a recent study looking at deliberation, four cars were described using positive and negative attributes. The terms were 70% positive for the first car, 50% positive for the next two, and just 25% for the last vehicle. Okay. After reading the description, some people were told to think about the cars for 4 minutes before choosing their favorite, while others were asked to solve anagrams during the time. When the list of attributes was long, 12 rather than 4, the anagram group of unconscious thinkers consistently made better decisions than those who pondered the information. Okay, so the anagram, so yeah, the more that you fill up the brain. This implies it might be often beneficial to delegate more complex matters to the unconscious. Similarly, tests have shown the same with posters and assessments of jobs, applications, and strawberry jam. There you go. Some tests have shown posters, whatever it is, assessments of job applications and strawberry jam. We can't always trust our instincts, but our conscious minds isn't all it's cracked up to be either. How should we think about how we think? According to Osman, no type of reasoning should be consigned to the scrap heap. Our gut feelings and intuitions, as well as explicit reasons, have been informed by evidence around us, even when we aren't consciously aware of it. Instead, she advises being critical about thinking. This means you should challenge all types of thinking, not just your instincts, says Osman. Quote, it's useful to look at how well we scrutinize the information available, to what degree we're motivated in making decisions and our motivations, she says. Just saying, why do I think that, or imagining yourself in the opposite position can be useful. Yeah, I think that's, I think, but also the fact, I tend to think that hierarchies do very, very badly, where people lose ownership of their problem. They only own their capacity, their hard to do becomes autonomous. Kahneman agrees that it's a good idea to be sceptical, particularly when the statistics are unfold. If it's a statistical angle, don't trust yourself. However, he isn't convinced about people trying to think better. He has hope in other areas, though. When it comes to institutions and organizations making decisions, they are much slower, and so there is more room for improvement. This might involve people challenging views during discussions, taking time to review all the evidence between meetings, or inviting people with fresh perspective. Unfortunately, the most day-to-day choices, measured deliberation, just isn't possible. So, if you fell for the bat and ball problem, don't beat yourself up about getting it wrong. Next time you might outsmart your own thought processes. Just take a moment and ask whether it's time for a rethink. Okay, that's incredibly complex, that last thing. I sort of like that. She was obviously had sat with that novel. You can see these birds around making heaps of sound. It's 26 minutes in, and hopefully we're coming to the end of this New Scientist. I can read the scientist sheet of paper. It says, interview with someone who's smiling at me. Oh dear, how to print a heart. This is really interesting, I think. How can vital human organs be made with a 3D printer? Bioprinting pioneer Jennifer Lewis thinks they can. She says her plan. So the entire thing, I think, with cell heating, or cell structure heating, is that you can't heat it up. You heat it up, you kill the cell. That's the fundamental problem. So it's a lot of what you want to do, heat or UV curing, the curing process is a killer with it. Okay. So, so the person speaking is Jennifer Lewis, and Sean O'Neill is the person asking the questions. And there's a picture of removal strands of fugitive inks is crucial for 3D printing of issues of tissues such as kidneys. The 3D printing revolution is here, from guns and houses to prosthetic limbs and vehicle parts. If you can think it, you can print it. Well, actually not true. Or you can, as long as it's an inanimate matter. But imagine being able to print a kidney, a brand new beating heart. Jennifer Lewis of Harvard University, who runs a team at the living edge of 3D bioprinting, is aiming to do just that. Isn't that beautifully personal? I wish I could do that. Right. The question, what do you see as being the long-term goal of bioprinting? So this Jennifer Lewis answers. The ability to print and implant vital organs. Surely this ability to print it, the 3D printing doesn't implant the vital organ. Perhaps the first step will be an implanted tissue patch that would augment or repair a damaged organ, but clearly the holy grail would be to engineer vital organs such as kidney or heart or liver. To do so for those three organs would be a tremendous value. That's what people are chasing, and the research group I'm part of focused on. That's just absolutely staggeringly mad, especially for kidney, for liver. Did you say liver? Yeah, it's a liver. Liver, it's one of these things that you can keep on cutting out and it regrows. How close would you say we are to printing an organ? Her reply. We're still decades away. It's not enough to just print liver cells or cardiac cells or kidney cells. The cells have to function. They have to mimic the high densities of the living tissue. Oh my God, it'll just blow apart in my view. An organ performs many functions in the body, so we have to be able to replicate it and put it into the body without the body rejecting it. There are so many challenges. We're also pursuing goals with immediate impact. For example, the pharmaceutical industry spends about $1 billion bringing a single drug to market, yet 20% of the drugs fail trials. So, on average, they lose $300 million. But the $800 million perhaps pays for itself. Because these trials are toxic to the kidneys. So 20%... Oh, no, that's... Okay, so there could be more than 20% failure, but a fifth all trial because it kills the kidney. But surely they'd do the kidney first and then save the cost of bringing... No, this is the entire thing. This is what I don't like about it. You spend $1 billion to bring a drug to market. If 50% of all drugs you think about fail with the kidney, you're not going to spend your $1 billion and then do the kidney test at last. You do the kidney step before you spend $1 billion. This is really whack. But it's still nonetheless the pharmaceutical who's got the best artificial kidney is best. So we can see the ability to print kidney tissue is an important focus. The logic's not there in that statement because it takes $1 billion to have a successful drug which has passed, say, 10 clinical trials. And there's all this, besides clinical trials, then you've funded the lobby groups and all that. Then if your first clinical trial is the big one, is the kidney test, is going to be before you spent your $1 billion. What progress have you made on kidney tissue? We've been working with collaborators at Birmingham and Women's Hospital in Boston to create many kidney building blocks, which have many of the key features of kidneys. We want to use those build up a volume of tissue that is big enough to essentially function like a kidney. Using this approach, we ultimately want to create a three-dimensional organs with their own blood vessels. I've got my skepticism about the whole thing. All these organs look like normal human organs. I think from the perspective of capturing imagination, it's very important for people to see tissue printed in the shape that they're already familiar with. Otherwise, it might freak them out. Oh, no, I think there's a number of reasons our kidneys are kidney-shaped. It's interesting if you've seen a cow kidney, that's got heaps of... That's really weird, a cow kidney. But there are lots of interesting shapes you can print that don't correspond to... Yes, hun? Tactile shapes and human organs. Hello, back recording after filling up about... Something like 8 or 9 jars of tomato relish. Really yum stuff. Even hot. Because it's better when it's cold and brought in the fridge for a while. Okay, we're about organs. What brought you to the idea of bioprinting organs in the first place? Colleges at the University of Illinois wanted to make a self-healing material. The idea was to emulate the body. You cut yourself, blood flows from the blood vessels to your vascular networks to form clots, so your skin heals. Together, we figured out how to 3D print a network of channels, microvascular, inside a synthetic material. This advance enabled a new class of self-healing polymers, i.e. they've got juice inside them, so if you cut them, the part A and part B go together. It was also a light bulb moment. I had never tried printing live cells before, but I had been watching tissue engineering field closely, so I realized that we'd overcome the obstacle that had been blocking it, holding it back. So I decided to translate this approach to living materials around 2010. So what was that breakthrough? You can't print living cells in 3D if there's no vascular to carry nutrients or blood to those cells. They will simply die. So we use fugitive ink to create patterns of tiny cylinders with a 3D printed tissue. The crucial thing was that the ink is erasable. After you printed the tissue, you can remove that part, leaving behind open channels akin to vascular. Mm. What is fugitive ink and how does it work? This is the question I was going to ask. It's a substance designed to gel at room temperature. It comes out of the printer nozzle in a cylindrical shape and keeps its shape when printed structure. I suppose it would have it water soluble as well, and I thought it might be it. It keeps its structure when printed. However, if you cool it down to 4 degrees, the gel goes from being solid to liquid, which is the opposite of how materials normally behave. It's also, I think you'd be able to increase a nitrogen, an arc in atmosphere, or heaps of things. That was secret sauce, in a way, because you're printing structure with living cells at room temperature. You have to heat the structure up to liquefy the fugitive ink, then all the cells will die. But, graciously, cells stay alive when you cool them down. It's a very simple idea. Yet, it also gave us the ability to vascularize 3D printed models of human tissues, overcoming a huge challenge in the field. It seems like things are progressing fast. I think of Moore's Law, which predicts exponential gains within computing power. The number of transistors on a computer chip has been roughly doubling every 2 years or so since the 1970s. The question is, does blue bioprinting follow its own version of Moore's Law? Without vascular networks, researchers would only print issues that were 1 millimeter thick. We've shown that you can print vascularized tissues to around 1 centimeter thick. That means bioprinting is starting to scale exponentially. When you print heart tissue, does it start beating itself? Heart cells within a printed tissues do start beating synchronously, but it doesn't happen immediately. First, they beat asynchronously until the tissue fuses together and beats as a collective unit, which is your heart does. It takes several days or so for the process to happen. Then the tissue starts beating more strongly and the synchrony increases. It is interesting because the heart tissue is half muscle, half nerve impulse. So you sort of set the scene for living tissues, giving it what it needs to get going, and then step back and let nature take over? That's right. We believe that to create these organ-specific tissues means printing some minimalistic architecture that contains the appropriate cells, the vasculature and support scaffold. But you let biology do as much of the building and assembly as possible, because we're already programmed to create our own tissues. If you give cells the right clues, they can do a lot on their own. Well, that's possible, I think, there. Could your technology displace animal testing by letting us check drugs on printed organs? I think that's what she says. Yes, but you don't need a full organ to test drugs. We currently are focused on creating three-dimensional human tissue models that could be used for both toxicity testing and disease modelling. Specifically, we are creating 3D kidney tissues housed within chips in collaboration with a major pharma. See her printing model at the back. Okay. Culture. Timely lessons. This is a book review. Today's impulsive politics needs a dose of geology's long-term mindset, finds Mick O'Hare. The first thought that springs up, so it's timefulness. Rather, it's like mindfulness. How thinking like a geologist can help save the world. Well, geologists I've known have always been absolutely drunk, misogynistic people. Not the female ones, obviously, but just off their face. Because they used to, well, in my day, they used to have to have a four-wheel drive and live rough. I think it's changed, obviously. The first thought that springs to mind when picking up Marcia Bourgeonneau's timefulness is it's a little nod in the direction of mindfulness, a notion that paying more attention to the present of our busy, whizzing lives whiz by. Our psychological health, argue enthusiasts, benefits from living that way, offering a clarity that is absent when we worry or concern ourselves with the past or future. If that's the intention, then it takes only a few pages to discover Bourgeonneau's book is arguably a geological antithesis to such a modern-day affection. Instead, she wants us to consider the past very deeply, to learn its lessons so we're better prepared for the future. The book's subtitle how thinking like a geologist can help you save the world is both an explanation of its contents and a stark warning that we cannot sit back in the present and merely hope for the best. Essentially, her idea is both sound and simple to grasp. Very long time scales are hard for us to comprehend. Timefulness, she tells us, gives us, quote, a clear-eyed view of our place in time, capital T-I-M-E. So that's interesting that, yeah, that we've got the word universe and time, capital letter. So this is something for the textbooks. Both the past that come along before us and the future will elapse without us. In other words, don't just concern yourself with the here and now. She wants us to learn what happened long before people occupied Earth, and consequently to teach us about long-term processes shaping our future. Time is not our enemy, she argues, accusing humanity of fearing its passing. Drawing on Woody Allen's, she notes, Americans believe death is optional, an example of our chronophobia. She fears short-term selfishness in politics and our personal lives may doom our species and others. She pleads to think long-term, aim take aim at religion too, especially the notion of creation scientists. It's not only contends that the world is a mere few thousand years old, but suggests life is preordained, so there's no point in fighting things such as species destruction and climate change. That's interesting. She has zero tolerance for such brain-fogging pseudoscience, and despairs the existence of atrocities like Kentucky's Creation Museum. I'd love to go. Wouldn't that be great to go to the Creation Museum? Or, as you can imagine, get in the way of timelessness, which is not as bad as what you see in some churches. The geological story is frequently wonderful. Bjergsen writes about zircon crystals found in the Jack Hills in Australia, the oldest terrestrial minerals ever discovered, and what they teach us about the ancient Earth and its formation and behaviour. It's a lesson on how to make an obscure subject fascinating. Another triumph is the portrayal of the Great Oxidation Event. This is, I think, when the Devonian, when we started making oxygens. The time when changes in the Earth's atmosphere transform the possibilities of life. She makes it so interesting. Her comparison of the high levels of carbon dioxide today with the similar levels 55 million years ago teaches us that climate processes to expect if we continue to down our current destructive price. So 55 million years ago is about a good old 10 million years after the impact. I suppose that must have been due to volcanism. It's always a challenge to make geology accessible to a popular audience, but timelessness is never impenetrable and despairing in the issue, its use of jargon. New Scientist readers will have little difficulty following the heartfelt narrative. Isn't that beautiful that she's speaking to her audience? Bourgeois' book is a manifesto for humanity, but on a very long time scale. Despite her implicably argued appeal for new geological awareness that could help us think beyond the next week, it seems destined to fall on deaf ears. Yeah, I would agree. We are, after all, living in an ad hoc time of Donald Trump and Brexit, and of the repugnant spheres created by Vladimir Putin's Hungary's Viktor Orban and Italian's Matteo Salvini. It is a political maelstrom where nobody seems to care what the next minute will bring, let alone the next epoch. And our leaders seem to act on whim, espousing whatever slogan gives them another day in power. Perhaps it's time to mail a copy to one each of them. As if, well, that's a bit sad. Okay. Carving up the earth. The Anthropocene. So this is... the Holocene is when the post that... Ice ages began to retract. The Anthropocene is the time of human contact, the human, the plastics and stuff like that. It's a movie. Okay. So a powerful film points to the destructive ways, finds Louise Fabiani. Quote, this film is not shot without a traditional script, runs a statement after the credits of the Anthropocene, a human epoch. Well, that's what it means. It's there just in case there's any doubt left after viewing the film outside the usual norms. Oh dear, that's a bit in your face. Whatever the filmmakers set up in a mine or near a landfill, they waited for the story to unfold in bearing witness and not leading to its agenda. The writer and director Jennifer Bashwell, cinematographer Nicholas DePersa, and photographer Edward Berson equipped the audience with to do the same. The result is a visual tone poem reminiscent of the 1982 film Koyaanisqatsi. So my wife is blind, was not impressed with it. With its first of a trilogy, directed by Jeffrey Rico, with music by Philip Gass. Thanks to an editing pace that echoes the slow pan of DePersa's camera, the audience is neither jolted out of gripping scenes before its importance sinks in, nor tripped into despair due to overexposure. Anthropocene is part of a trilogy, Manufactured Landscapes, 2006, Watermark in 2013, the Anthropocene, so it goes Manufactured Landscapes, Watermark, and Anthropocene. All features sweeping shots across altered landscapes, little narration. Actor Alicia Vindaga lends her voice to Anthropocene and spare evocative music. The film's contribution to the argument about adding the Anthropocene, coined by Nobel Prize winner Paul Crutzen in 2000, to a geological timeline. A final decision by the International Commission on Stratigraphy is pending. Oh, International Commission on Stratigraphy. The current epoch, the Holocene, began some 11,000 years ago. The main evidence for the Anthropocene is the fossilization of human artifacts such as plastics, radionuclides, concrete, technofossils, and quadrillions of chicken bones from factories. Scientists also cite unusual levels of nitrogenous compounds, I'd say, or phosphates and things, a spike in the carbon seen in ice cores, and precipitous drops of many species. The most striking segment of the film is the transformation of our planet. To create consumer goods, we gouge and scour the Earth's surface to extract ore and oil. One startling example of Germany shows the erasure of villages, croplands and forests for open-pit coal mining, leaving many square kilometres of post-apocalyptic devastation. In Chile, vast fields of metal lithium are dry in the sun. Not metal, wouldn't it be salt lithium? Lithium salts? In the marble quarry of Carrara, Italy, workers remove large sections of stone with hand tools and machinery. In an aerial view, it looks like a gigantic blue-veined white niggard with giant green teeth marks. It's easier, either confronting or distressing, to learn that it is old enough to have supplied Michelangelo. Then there is landfill. At the site of Nairobi, Kenya, coloured plastic tyres stacked in layers as if readying itself for millennia of stratification. Children wander scavenging with their bare hands, watched over by scores of sentinel-like stalks. The result is gratifying. Our desires are everywhere. In 1909, Kenya ceremonially burnt ivory of 10,000 elephants in a bid to show slow the trade. So that would be 20,000 tusks, if it's two tusks an elephant. Nothing could restore the magnificent creatures, but did it prevent even one trinket being made from those tusks? At the start and end of the film, we see the ivory carvers surrounded by their work, exquisite but searing images of world literally carved by us. Oh, I like that, the ivory cutters, and we're cutting into it. So the elephant goes with it. Now, I know, another AI story. Culture. This is an art about AI. Douglas Heaven discovers artists playing cat and mouse with face recognition software. non-facial portrait, Seoul Medicity Biennale, Seoul Museum of Art. Okay. 9 portraits hang on a wall. Their mouths and eyes have been scrubbed out, faces painted over, or dissected with thick smears of colour until the sitter sinks out of sight. This resistant art, the revolution will not be recognised. Oh, I will not be recognised. Okay. Non-facial portrait is an installation by the South Korean artists Shin Sheng Bak and Kim Yong Hong, commissioned for the Seoul Media City Biennale in 2018. An exhibition at the Seoul Museum of Art, the work is one of the many examples underlying just how complicated it's becoming to tease apart human complex and the complex machines they create. The duo set 9 fellow artists a task. Paint a portrait of Kim that a human recognized as a face, but a computer running 3 different face recognition algorithms would not. The project was an experiment, says Shin. Could the artist find the shrinky space that is still wholly human? If they failed, it would show a delicate situation we're facing, he said. Face recognition runs through Shin and Shim's works. A previous installation involved images of clouds in which the software had found faces. A special version was shown in UK Anne's Festival in 2015, with cameras scanning the skies above the Grizzel Forest in Cumbria to collect faces. We are used to mugshots being catalogued online. Facebook and Google use face recognition to tag people in uploaded photos, but video surveillance now comes with face recognition too. The crowds at Madison Square Garden in New York are scanned for known troublemakers. Cameras and pedestrian crossing Shenzhen, China, such as watch for jaywalkers. Some people have taken to wearing obfuscating headgear, from hats to scarves to camouflaging face paint, but the latest algorithms aren't fooled. Of course, a portrait by Picasso or Francis Bacon will probably escape fake recognition too. I wonder what Francis Bacon's portrait is. I'll have to look that up. But in non-facial portrait, the process of avoiding detection is a part of the work. Each portrait is exhibited next to a video showing the cat and mouse game and its painter played with the algorithms. A camera films the painter from above as they work. As soon as the computer spots something in the canvas, it thinks of the face. A red and green or blue square, one of each algorithm, highlights the bit of the face it has identified. The artists react by painting over the recognizable feature or adding blocks of color elsewhere to throw off the software. My God, this is so boring. Okay. It wasn't easy, says Shin. If you make a portrait closer to the subject, machines easily identify the face. And if you distort the face too much, the painting could not be seen as a portrait of a person. The audience is to decide if the artist succeeded or not. Wow, vain. This year's Seoul Media City Biennale is themed around the idea of living well after the ancient Athenian notion of eudaimonia, the good life or happiness. What is it? Epicurus. That's interesting. What's eudaimonia? I have to remember that. What's the three things I have to remember? The faces. The face of the Anthropocene. No. Okay, and I've even forgotten the word that I've just read there. Eudaimonia, whatever that is. Oh, Francis Bacon's portrait, Eudaimonia. Let's see if I can get those two things. Since the exhibition explores how well this notion fits into a high-tech future, it is no surprise that many artworks deal with AI. Human well being will largely depend on how we navigate the relationship with its technology. Another highlight of the Biennale is Us and Them by Seattle-based artist Mark Tyker, who has a day job at Google. Tyker's installation consisted of 20 printers that split out long strips of AI-generated political tweets by fake people with AI-generated faces. He trained his software on 200,000 tweets from accounts that were found after the US 2016 election was run by bots. In the middle of the ticker tape torrent of tweets are pairs of chairs inviting people to sit and talk. It is still fun to be had, though the line between humans and machines is growing fuzzy. It'll be more and more difficult to find unique human abilities as technologies develop further, says Jim. Back quote, but we need to keep looking for it, and not to find our supremacy over machines, but to know who we are. Well, that's a bit weird if you ask me. Okay, coming on to letters. Rewilding is not conservation. Okay, this is the idea that if you stop human occupation, it goes back to the wild state, which I think must be almost right. And the idea is that you get top predators coming in and the system regains balance. Graham Lawson describes rewilding as letting nature run things so it can right the wrongs we've done. Earth's Wildlife, 13th of October, page 24. It is easy to make the case for this in an area of virgin forest cut down a decade ago to produce palm oil, but where humans have been present for part of an ecosystem for thousands of years, the implication of their removal can be as destructive as the removal of any other major species. This is why the majority of 276 studies of abandoned farmland reviewed by the Stockholm Resilience Centre showed a reduction in biodiversity, especially in Europe. Some have tried to conflate rewilding with conservation to capitalise on the trend for it. In most cases, the terms are diametrically opposed. Rewilding an area where species have become reliant on humans means, by definition, their loss and replacement with others. Evidence occurs the all-too-often ignored observation and warnings by indigenous communities, but the rewilding bandwagon continues to gain momentum at alarming pace. That's always interesting. I'm just going to think in terms of the way that people make articles, make it very hard to leverage your way through it. So people do a comment, but the people are not going to read this letter. We have. Cars need safe and legal designs more than ethics. Now, I would definitely say so. Technology probably can't answer the question of whether to prioritise the lives of pedestrians or vehicle occupants during a driverless car crash, especially if it happens to be a pregnant doctor criminal. The biggest claim made by car makers is driverless cars will reduce traffic accidents, so it's reasonable for legislators to demand safety measures when giving permission for them to ride on public roads. Such measures could include smart front bumpers that are soft for adult leg impacts, even softer for children impacts, but still stiff when hitting other vehicles. These would make the front bumper more pedestrian friendly while still protecting the vehicle and bodywork in low-speed crashes. Car bonnets would be modified to reduce the force on pedestrians and head impacts, for example, by installing pedestrian airbags. This technology has been available for several years. We do these ethical things, but I think someone pointed out that SUVs kill twice as many people, so this is the same area. Another letter. White's article on who to spare an accidental highlights the different views on this various cultures. I know this is such a stupid answer. And cultures also affect science and hence may influence research on the subject. Surely the way to eliminate cultural bias is to let those who are creating the risk die and save the innocent participants who are in harm's way. For example, a car with failed brakes should crash so as to avoid pedestrians. Its patients haven't made it faulty, but the actions of travelling create a risk. Oh, this is interesting. So you should actually kill the designer and make it interesting. Questioning people about who they think should be saved in road accident might be useful in developing some sort of morality basis for driverless cars, but it's odd to frame it in terms of whether pedestrians are criminals or doctors. When an accident is imminent, either any humans involved nor any controlling artificial intelligence will be in possession of the full facts. I agree. It's such a stupid article anyway. Driverless cars don't need ethics. What they do need is to be capable of following the rules of the road. The bits about not running into people and common sense leave the ethics to philosophers. The wider point of the debate is that driverless cars won't be distracted by mobile phones, drink, drugged, and irrationally aggressive. They also obey speed limits and not overtake dangerously. This would instantly save hundreds of lives. Next, we are asked to whose life our driver's car would should appear in a crash. A family of four in the car, a pregnant woman, a doctor, and a criminal who are standing nearby. Is the latter one, two, or three people? That's what I said. Yeah, that's a good thing. Does the car decision depend on stereotypically how stereotypically it thinks? How neoliberal free for all is a liberal? David Cole criticizes Cybernox for suggesting that the liberal outlook is the default in Western society, and then says the large parts of society haven't thrived under neoliberal economics, and the bewildering social change deserves respect. The risks confusion of the word liberal. A liberal democracy is one in which universal franchise and the rule of law are essential. The interests of all people are served and not just certain sectors. It tends towards a welfare state. Neoliberalism is another name for laissez-faire liberalism or laissez-faire economics, which sees all human interactions as competitive market-driven transactions in which it is both inevitable and right that some become richer and more powerful than others, than others in the free market. The two are particularly much popular, polar opposites, and it's unfortunate that the similarity in names make it possible to confuse the two. What a beautiful theme. To Yoda's Law, listen very carefully for biodiversity. Strabseth and his team have developed a device that cheaply gauges rainforest biodiversity, interpreting the collective sound of different animals. I predict the result is Yoda's Law. This arose from efforts to maximize crops and is so-called the -3-on-2 distribution law. If you chart the mean weight of plants against the number of per unit area on logarithmic plots, so you don't double it's logarithmic on both scales, you'll get a -3-on-2 slope. You get a straight line with a downward slope of -3-on-2. This quantifies the observation. The more crowded plants, the smaller its life will be. The finding was later extended to the distribution of density of animals and birds, and yeah, that's Yoda's Law. That's interesting. And describes the law in the search of a theory. It would help in defining the area required to protect a species. For instance, predatory birds require a lot more territory than predatory mammals, followed by herbivorous birds, primates, and herbivorous mammals. Surely that's the density of prey is the major thing. Your report on skin cells engineered to make the enzyme that destroys cocaine, which may be implanted to treat drug addictions, I wonder whether a similar enzyme exists to destroy opioids and methamphetamines. Though, on reflection, I wonder how useful this might actually be. Do cravings lead people to take successfully larger doses outrun the therapy's ability to destroy the drug? In the case of opioids, would similar therapies render the drugs useless if the person later has a genuine medical need for them to relieve pain? That's a point. I wish I'd thought of that one. Cats pick fights with rats they can eat. There we go. So cats are bad at catching adult rats. Cats do like catching and eating juvenile rats, which have a fighting weight a fraction of an adult's. I've seen a neighbour's cat trot by with young rats in its mouth. Okay, well, that's a point. Stephen Horter's carings deserve credit too, so I don't have to read this to agree with it. Tributes to Stephen Hawking slightly admire the mental resilience that enabled him to live a productive life with an overwhelming physical disability, including his daughter, Lucy Hawking. None that I come across mentioned the carers who enabled him to go on living. I've searched and found only that he needed four full-time carers carrying out for him daily activities that most of us take for granted. Then there were the technicians who designed and built the equipment that enabled him to be mobile and to communicate. These are the people of heroes of Hawking stories. I'll just pop down to the battery swap station. Question. Alice Klein's comparison between hydrogen-powered and battery-powered vehicles was interesting. In a country like Australia, the limited range of either type of vehicle outside the major cities will be a problem for some time to come. for example, because of the lack of fast charging points. But we can always learn from history, such as a battery-powered buses for London in the century ago. They were turned around in minutes by swapping depleted batteries with fully charged ones. If a manufacturer of battery-powered vehicles today could agree on a limited set of standard batteries, fuel stations could quite quickly offer battery swaps. This sort of service already operates for liquid petroleum gas bottles. Most users don't own a bottle, but simply swap it at the full when empty. If a moon has a moon, what to call it? Great fleas live on fleas and on their backs at bottom, and little fleas have lesser fleas, and so ad infinitum. You get more and more less, you know, more perturbed. You're working in space to get more moons around moons. We now have moons. May some have moons, so moons. We might need to abbreviate to M3 moons and M4 moons and so on. Future streets littered with high-tech e-gum. Oh, that's something I didn't think of yet. Okay. The report on chewing gum, which is a piezoelectric crystal element, the electrodes wrapped in a plastic film. Now, what are the environmental consequences of such products? Our parents are already heavily stained and discarded chewing gum. Not anymore in Australia. They steam clean it off, mate. Will the new chewing gum be discarded, adding to plastic pollution? We foresee belated legislation demanding dedicated disposal bins at the point of sale. And if things last as long as promised, these things will take ages to fill up. Oh, yeah. They couldn't resist answering that, could they? And we're going to the last section here. Fobbed off. When I use the electronic key to fob lock and lock my car, no other cars marked as its locks activated. This is as it should be, but how does the system work? It's a pseudo random number sequence. You keep on firing it and it looks down to see if you're in a pseudo random number sequence. So it sends an individual pseudo random number each time to keep count. So that's why you pay so much for the bloody things. The principle of electronic car locks works in much the same way as traditional lock and key. The key fob transmits the coded binary sequences, and this matches the coded program in the receiver of the lock releases. To guard against the possibility of that someone might intercept and record the code of an unauthorized use, the more sophisticated use of an algorithm allows the code sequence to be changed at every key press. Okay. I'll finish now and put this up. The other articles are not really interesting. Another podcast, another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.